Hello and welcome to today's World Report. Coming up on the show, we hear how some Central European towns are recovering after a wave of devastating floods. We'll also be finding out about the unique Fête de l'Humanité festival, which is taking place on the outskirts of Paris this year. But first, we go to Lebanon, where rescue workers are continuing to search through the rubble in Beirut following a series of Israeli strikes on Friday. A number of buildings were hit in the south of the city, with senior Hezbollah commander Ibrahim Akil among those killed. As of last night, at least 37 people were killed in the strikes, including 3 children, according to Hezbollah officials. It comes as a further 39 people died and over 3,000 were injured when pagers and walkie-talkies were detonated over Wednesday and Thursday. Hannah McCarty has more from Beirut.
A digger is grappling with the piles of rubble that is all that's left of 2 buildings that once stood on this spot in Dahiye, a densely populated neighbourhood and Hezbollah stronghold in southern Beirut. In a bunker, metres below the now flattened multi-storey building, a group of Hezbollah members had held a fateful meeting on a Friday afternoon. It was attended by Ibrahim Akil, a senior Hezbollah commander who had been released from hospital earlier that day, after he was injured in the pager attacks that hit hundreds of Hezbollah members on Tuesday. It would be followed a day later by a smaller but more lethal wave of attacks involving detonating walkie-talkies. The attack, which has been widely attributed to Israel, sowed chaos and terror across Lebanon, particularly among Hezbollah members. Hezbollah's leader described the attacks using hundreds of wireless devices as a declaration of war. With the Iran-backed paramilitary group no longer able to rely on pagers and walkie-talkies, and fearful of Israeli or American surveillance while using normal phones, meeting in person must have seemed like the only way to have a discussion on how to respond to the series of embarrassing security breaches and attacks on Hezbollah's members. A group of Hezbollah commanders, including Akil and elite fighters from the Radwan unit, travelled to the underground bunker in Dahiye on Friday. The decision would be a fatal mistake for 14 of those Hezbollah members who were targeted by ground-penetrating Israeli missiles fired from the sky by an F-35 jet. The force of the missile strikes blew the sides off many of the surrounding buildings. I could see the open cabinets of one kitchen lying exposed, with a washing machine perched on an open ledge 5 stories high. I spoke with someone living nearby who said their apartment shook violently when the missiles struck the ground. One Ethiopian woman working for a family nearby described having to climb over rubble to escape her building. Soon after the attack, which was immediately claimed by Israel, families began posting photos online, trying to learn the whereabouts of their missing loved ones. Some were located in hospitals nearby, while 37 had been confirmed dead, including 7 women and 3 children. When I arrive at the site on Saturday, a group of locals are there still waiting for news of their missing loved ones. 17 are still believed to be somewhere under the rubble. A worker told me that no one was expected to be discovered alive at this point. A group of volunteers from the Lebanese Red Cross were on standby, but no one was expecting to rush anyone to hospital at this point. Hezbollah has a political wing with members of the Lebanese parliament, and that includes Minister of Public Works and Transport Ali Hamia, who visited the site on Saturday and said that the bombing of a residential building constituted a war crime and that Israel was dragging the region into a war. A short drive away, a funeral was being held for 3 of the Hezbollah members killed in the strike on Friday. A sea of black clothing punctured by bright yellow flags with the emblem of Hezbollah cascaded through the streets. The crowd was largely divided by gender, with men and older boys standing together and women and young children elsewhere. After walkie-talkies detonated at a funeral on Wednesday for victims of the pager attacks the day before, the atmosphere was uneasy today. Soldiers stood watch at the edge of the event and bags were all searched. Some men walked by with red-coloured eyes, another with a bandaged hand. Perhaps wounds from the pager attacks that had hit so many from this neighbourhood in southern Beirut. Prayers were recited across speakerphones, but the low hum of Israeli drones could be heard in between the music. Attendees pledged themselves to Allah and Hezbollah while fists punched the air. The 3 coffins of the slain Hezbollah fighters were draped in Hezbollah flags and carried through the crowds, as if levitating across a black river. Some women cried while others took photos of their children standing by the photos of the fallen fighters. These children, part of the latest generation to grow up amid war in Lebanon. For World Report in Beirut, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Next, we go to Central Europe, as the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has promised €10 billion in immediate aid to countries hit by a wave of catastrophic floods during Storm Boris. Czechia, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, Austria, Romania, and parts of northern Italy have all been affected. At least 23 people have died, while in Czechia alone, over 13,000 people were evacuated from their homes. In northeast Moravia and Silesia, near the Polish border, some towns and villages have been devastated. Rob Cameron has more on this story from Prague.
In a seemingly endless gallery of heart-rending images, it was somehow the most affecting. In the front yard of a small house in a village near the Silesian city of Opava, next to ruined fridge freezers and sodden carpets and mud-soaked sofas, a family had carefully hung up a string of documents to dry in the sun. Attached by clothes pegs to a washing line stretched between two piles of bricks, it was easy to read the Czech word at the top of each one of them, Vysvěcení. It means school report and lists the grades the pupil had achieved at the end of that year. As the father of two children in the Czech school system, I know well how precious is this document. It's probably not the end of the world if you lose it, but for most parents it takes on the air of a holy relic placed in a plastic sheath and stored in a ring binder for years to come. I actually know this region quite well. It follows a craggy line that marks the Czech-Polish border. It includes Silesia, or rather that bit of the old Habsburg land of Silesia that found itself in Czechoslovakia rather than Poland after the dissolution of the empire in 1918. In 2007, I spent 19 days travelling across the Czech Republic by slow train with a friend, setting foot in more than 80 towns and villages, and sometimes nipping across the border into Germany, Poland, Slovakia, and Austria. Around halfway through the trip, on day 10 to be precise, we arrived in Silesia, in the delightful mountain spa town of Jeseník. It wasn't that auspicious of an arrival, marked with some Germanic black eagles on the town's landmarks and a few beers and a curry in a pub. Our waiter wasn't even sure where Silesia began or ended, but was fairly confident we were in it. The next day we took a train that would end up at another small Czech Silesian town, but it took a detour in Poland on the way. It stopped at a town called Głukowazy. The station was a rather sinister dark red brick. In those pre-Schengen days, the rather rotund Polish border guards on the platform didn't quite know whether we had the right to be there or not, but soon sent us on our way to check out the town centre. That evening we were back on the Czech side, in the town of Krnov, which improbably has a large Greek population, refugees from the Civil War. A night there, and we were on our way to Opava, the old Silesian capital, a splendid place with a wonderful Art Nouveau town hall where there was a brass band playing in the park. So there are distant memories and a cache of photos of these forgotten, out-of-the-way places, rarely visited even by most Czechs. But I dug out those photos this week and try to match them up with the distressing images of towns turned into lakes with roofs emerging from them. Videos showing firefighters being winched to safety from the roof of their fire engine by the army, and then the clean-up operation of mud, mud, and more mud. Opava, Krnov, Jeseník, Głukowazy, all these wonderful, quirky, ancient Silesian towns have been very much in the news for the past 7 days, and sadly, for all the wrong reasons. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Next, we go to France, where the famous Fête de l'Humanité, or Festival of Humanity, kicked off on Friday. 450,000 people are attending this unique event, which combines left-wing politics with some of the country's most famous musical acts. It was initially set up in 1930 to help fund the newspaper, and it has since hosted the likes of Stevie Wonder, Pink Floyd, The Who, and Deep Purple. Along with the big names, trade unions, NGOs, activists, and many other national and international associations hold a presence at it. This year there were some familiar Irish parties at it too, as Rory Mulholland has been finding out.
I've lived in France for more than 2 decades, and every year I swear I will go to the Fête de l'Humanité, the Festival of Humanity. And every year I fail to make it. But last weekend I finally bit the bullet and took the suburban train out to a former airbase near Paris that now hosts what is France's biggest cultural event. Little did I think that I would run into a delegation from Sinn Féin or see a James Connolly lookalike at a stand for the Irish Communist Youth Movement. This year, a record 450,000 people attended the Fête de l'Humanité over its 3 days. It's a bizarre mix of rock festival and political gathering that hosts some of France's top music groups as well as its leading left-wing politicians. It's been going on for almost a century and is run by L'Humanité, France's communist daily newspaper, to raise funds to keep the paper going. Most who attend are youngsters out for a weekend of revelry and rock and roll, but it also draws members of what remains of France's once powerful Communist Party, along with supporters of the country's various left-wing movements. The festival had a particular relevance this year given the political upheaval in France since President Emmanuel Macron called snap parliamentary elections in June after Marine Le Pen's far-right Rassemblement National came out top in European elections. It was a left-wing coalition, the Nouveau Front Populaire, which won most votes in the parliamentary election, but Macron refused to allow anyone from the coalition to become prime minister. He instead appointed Michel Barnier, a conservative and the man who led the Brussels side of the Brexit negotiations. This infuriated the left-wing parties and a large swathe of the French population. So the outraged lefties who accuse Macron of what they call a denial of democracy had a lot to talk about at the Fête de l'Humanité. This year's programme included a host of music groups that may be unknown in Ireland, but are big names in France. Elsewhere, there was a range of leading lefty politicians engaging in debates or making fiery speeches. Other events included workshops on topics such as how to defeat the, quote, patriarchal, racist, capitalist system, end of quote, how to combat the far right, or what to do about, quote, the repression of youth by the state. And of course, there were dozens of food stands dotted across the festival grounds, one of whose thoroughfares was called Rue Bobby Sands. But perhaps the oddest thing, for me at least, was the presence of two Irish political movements. Almost the first thing I saw when I arrived at the festival was a tent with a Sinn Féin banner fluttering above it. I went inside and found three men there. Unprompted, they said they had no booze left, having sold their several barrels of Guinness over the previous 2 nights. They didn't have any leaflets or Sinn Féin propaganda to distribute. "We're essentially a pub," said one of them. He explained that they load up a van with booze every year and take the ferry from Dublin to Cherbourg to come to the Fête de l'Humanité. We chatted for a while and then I continued my exploration of France's annual communist frolic. As I was leaving, I saw an Irish tricolour flying above another tent. I wandered over and saw a large banner proudly proclaiming the presence of the Mouvement des Jeunes Communistes d'Irlande, otherwise known as the Connolly Youth Movement. The chap manning the stand was clearly aiming to resemble the James Connolly who organised Irish Labour and was executed for his role in the Easter Rising of 1916. He and his Irish comrade at the stand, like their Sinn Féin counterparts, also make an annual pilgrimage to the Fête de l'Humanité. But they take the ferry from Cork to Roscoff in Brittany before driving down to Paris. And in a clear demarcation from Sinn Féin, they bring barrels of Beamish Stout and not Guinness. But they too were almost out of drink by the time I rocked up at their tent. All they had left was Cabernet Sauvignon and a small amount of what they billed as whisky artisanal, or homemade whiskey. For World Report, this is Rory Mulholland in Paris.
And that's it from World Report today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or go to wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week, so until then, from myself, Gavin O'Callaghan, and all of the team, thanks for listening and take care.